Good afternoon and welcome. Rob, can you see the screen from there? Okay. Just making sure. Good morning, afternoon, good now. We'll get to it. It's good to see everybody here. I do appreciate your presence. As was mentioned this morning, that we're going to begin a new series, so I will do this for a few months. I don't know exactly how long this particular series is going to be, but we're going to talk about some of the things that Bonnie and I were able to see while we were at the British Museum. We were blessed with the opportunity to go to London actually twice. The British Museum is huge and free, and so we went there the first time we were there, and I took pictures of everything I could, and I missed a lot. And then we went back a second time, and we spent a few hours there, and it closed. And so then the next day, we went back, and we went to the British Museum again. And if I could go to London again, I would spend another day at the British Museum. It is amazing. And you may not be all that interested in history or in museums, but it's amazing for Christians. It is worth going for that reason alone. However, you kind of need to know what you're looking for, because the British Museum is not there to say, hey, everybody, come here, the Bible is real and we'll prove it. That's not what it's about, and that's good, because then they might be biased. But instead, it's just about archaeologists wanting to tell us about history. And in that history, we find truths that we find within the Bible. How do you know you can trust the Bible? There are a lot of answers to that. But when we get into a court case and somebody comes up and they accuse someone else of a crime, they're a witness. And now we have to decide, is that witness somebody who's reliable, somebody that we can count on? And so the prosecutor and the defense are both going to spend time interrogating this person to find out, do they always tell the truth? And if they don't, well then, we don't rely on them anymore, because there's somebody who might tell a lie. But if there's somebody who always tells the truth, when they tell you something else, you tend to believe it. I have made a mistake. Randy, you're kind of on the corner. Could you get the front lights off for me? Thank you. I meant to do that. Okay, so here's what we're going to find, and here's why we're going to do this. This is just part one. We're only going to look at a little bit, and we're going to do it in the order in which Bonnie and I went through the museum this last time. So things might be chronologically out of order, but more about talking about specific areas. And here's why we're doing this. The purpose of the series is so that we understand the support of the Bible. History supports what you read. These are not just made-up names and made-up places. You will see real places, real people, real events, and accurate descriptions as well. That it'll say, describe a certain people in this way, and then we find them to be that way through history. In addition, it is so that we can better understand the Bible, so that you can have more richness as you read, and also to understand that the more knowledge you have of history, the more you can understand the Bible. I admit, when I was in school, history was boring. I did not care for history all that much. However, I've gained an appreciation for history as I start to see how it relates to things and how it is important to our lives. So this is why we're going through this series. So let's start off and do a little bit of I want to call it geometry. That's not geometry. Let's look at maps. Okay, I want you to understand some of the kingdoms. So the basic history of the Old Testament, we have God's people starting in the book of Exodus. We have God's people down in Egypt, down here. God calls them out of Egypt. They go through the wilderness, and they end up taking the promised land, marked as Canaan here. And this is the promised land. And then the people divide, and so you have one nation that becomes two nations, the northern and the southern. So we have this part, here's the southern, and this part up here's the northern. And the northern kingdom disobeys God, and so God brings this mighty nation, the Assyrians, which are up here with the capital of Nineveh. The Assyrians come, and they conquer really everything you pretty much see on this screen, with the exception of one little spot right here. They conquer everybody except for the southern kingdom. They're the one that stands. But that was a punishment that came from God. But the southern kingdom is disobedient, and so later the Babylonians conquer the Assyrians and then take over everything you see on here, including the southern kingdom, and they're taken away. Today, in this morning's, this afternoon's lesson, we're really primarily going to be talking about the Assyrians. We're just going to look at them. We're going to talk about them again later because there's more to talk about. But so this is a mighty nation that existed for a good long time, and the northern and southern kingdom had a decent number of incidents dealing with them, whether it be treaties or whether it be battles and victories and losses. We find the Assyrians talked about fairly frequently in the Bible. But before I get to the Assyrians, I have to admit we're going to talk about Egypt and one time about Babylon first. But if you're not sure where we're looking at on the map, what part of the world, this one shows us the modern nations. So Saudi Arabia is here, Egypt, Israel, the Gaza, Syria, Iraq, this is Iran, that's Turkey. So that kind of gives you an idea of what area of the world we're talking about. Okay, so you go into the British Museum, and one of the biggest pieces that they have, not size, but just as far as importance, of archaeological importance, is this one called the Rosetta Stone, and you've probably heard about that one. This is not the Rosetta Stone. This is actually the Rosetta Stone duplicate, because the Rosetta Stone, one, always has a crowd around it, and two, has glass, and so when I take a picture of it, you see a picture of me, and that's not all that interesting. But this is a duplicate they have in there, and it's neat because it says at the bottom, please touch. And not very often in a museum do they tell you to please touch. But so you can see, here's the Rosetta Stone, and if you're not familiar with the Rosetta Stone is it was a crucial piece of history to unlock Egypt. The Egyptian languages were dead. They were gone. And so we had all of this writing all over the place, and it meant nothing to anybody until we found this stone. Because this stone has Greek, all capital letters, no spaces, and Greek never died. And so we were able to translate that without too much difficulty. And then we saw this, and this is demotic Egyptian, and then above that is hieroglyphics, which you've probably heard of more often, which we didn't know how to do. But as soon as they realized that this was that, they were able to unlock all of these languages. And every time they talk about what was happening in Egypt, that's because we found one stone. Now, why is this biblically significant to us? It's not hugely significant, but there are two things. One, this allowed us to understand Moses' language when he was in Egypt. So this, the hieroglyphics is the language that the Israelites would have been around while they were slaves in Egypt. And the second thing is, it's kind of interesting that we discovered something where they took the time to write it in three languages, because we find that in the Bible. When it's something important, you would sometimes write it in three languages. And what we find in John chapter 19, verses 20 and 22, when Jesus is crucified, we find something like the Rosetta Stone put up there, where you have three languages. It says, therefore many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Latin, and in Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews were saying to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but that he said, I am King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. And so what we find is that's not a shocking thing. That's something they did. They would write things into three different languages, and it was very useful for us. So let's not talk about Egypt again for a little while. We'll talk about that some other time. Let's talk about Babylon just for a second. So then, right next to the fake Rosetta Stone, behind some glass, there's a whole bunch of bricks, just little bricks like this. They're about the size of your shoe, a little bit bigger than that. My shoe. I did one picture so that I could tell the size, so I stuck my foot up there. So it's not your shoe, it's mine. Which, so you're talking about 18 inches, that's not how big my feet are. But my shoe comes about there. Yeah, I have huge feet. So anyway, a whole bunch of these bricks, which would have been over in Babylonian area, and they just have all these stamps. And so if you zoom in into that area, you can start to see language that you and I can't read. And so that's one brick. And then we have another brick. And then there's another brick. And all of those bricks, and this is just a few of them, but all these bricks, they happen to mention Nebuchadnezzar. That last one says, I am Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the eldest son of Nabopolassar. He's mentioned 91 times in the Bible. 91 times, and you've got Nebuchadnezzar being mentioned there. There's not a historian in the world who doubts Nebuchadnezzar's existence. And the Bible talks about him. Okay. Now let's get on to the Assyrians. This is the nation that conquers the northern kingdom. We're going to talk about them for a little bit. You're looking at the Black Obelisk. This is a well-known artifact. And what it does is it has a whole bunch of writing down here and a whole bunch of writing up here and a little bit in between these lines. And you can see there's pictures. There's five rows of pictures. It has four sides, and all four sides have the exact same concept. Different pictures, different words, but they all have the five rows of pictures and the writing up on top and the writing down at the bottom. And what it tells about is one of the kings, Shalmaneser III of the Assyrians. Shalmaneser is not in our Bible, not by name. We actually do find a Shalmaneser in the Bible. He's not the third, that's the fifth. So it's not the same guy. But this was really, really important. Because on this row, well, before I talk about that row, we're going to look at that row in a second. Up in the writing, up here, it talks about how Shalmaneser conquered nation after nation after nation. You know, he conquered the northern kingdom, right? That wasn't all he did. He also conquered Syria. And so it makes mention of his conquests of Ben-Hadad and Hazael. And if you look in your Bibles, you will find Ben-Hadad and Hazael mentioned. Ben-Hadad is mentioned 27 times. And then Ben-Hadad, his servant's name is Hazael in 2 Kings chapter 8, verses 7 through 15. I don't think I put that up here. I didn't. So let's turn and look at that real quick. So here, hundreds of miles away from the Bible lands, we find this black obelisk which describes these names. Then we turn to 2 Kings chapter 8, starting in verse 7, and we read about them. Elisha came to Damascus. Now Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, was sick, and it was told him, saying, "The man of God has come here." The king said to Hazael, "Take a gift in your hand and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord by him, saying, 'Will I recover from this sickness?' So Hazael went to meet him and took a gift in his hand, even every kind of good thing of Damascus, 40 camel loads. And he came and stood before him and said, 'Your son Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, has sent me to you, saying, "Will I recover from this sickness?" Then Elisha said to him, "Go say to him, 'You will surely recover, but the Lord has shown me that he will certainly die.'" He fixed his gaze steadily on him until he was ashamed, and the man of God wept. Hazael said, "Why does my Lord weep?" Then he answered, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the sons of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire, and their young men you will kill with the sword, and their little ones you will dash in pieces, and their women with the child you will rip up." Then Hazael said, "But what is your servant who is but a dog, that he should do this great thing?" And Elisha answered, "The Lord has shown me that you will be king over Aram." And so here we see Ben-Hadad is king. And then the Bible tells us that Elisha goes to Ben-Hadad and says, Hazael comes to Elisha asking about Ben-Hadad. And he tells him, he's not going to live. You're a servant, you're going to be king. Now, we go through history and we find out Ben-Hadad, no question, he existed. Hazael, no question, he existed. What about Elisha? After you read this story and you see, yes, both of them were kings of the nation that we're declared to be kings of in Assyria, and you read about both of them, don't you trust the Bible a little bit more when it tells us what Elisha did when it went from Ben-Hadad being king to Hazael? There's no question. It tells us about those two. They definitely existed. So we go back to the black obelisk, and this was that second row from the top that I was showing. And this is a picture of someone in your Bible. So there's my arrow. So that's Shalmaneser III, and the inscription up here is telling what's going on. And Shalmaneser does not conquer the northern kingdom, But he does get them to come to him for a treaty, to come to him and pay service. And so it records this man who is now kissing at the feet of Shalmaneser III. And it gives us an inscription up here. And the inscription up here says, "Tribute of Yahweh, son of Humri, I receive silver gold." However, if you were to translate that just a little bit further, it says, "Tribute of Jehu, son of Omri, I receive silver and gold." You can read in your Bibles about Jehu, the king, and Omri. You would find that to be a little odd, though, because Jehu is not Omri's son, nor is Jehu in the lineage of Omri. Jehu eliminates Omri. However, what we found is in Assyria, for a few decades, they considered the northern kingdom to be, sometimes they call it the sons of Omri, sometimes they called it Omri land. And so it's really just saying Jehu of the northern kingdom. But we read about this. We read about Jehu in 2 Kings 9 through 10 when he becomes king. And we read about Omri in multiple places as well. So then we go along to the next thing. And this, I believe, is also, let me check, make sure I get this right. This is the stele of three kings. You don't see three kings. That's because there's one here and one over here. This is just the stele on the left. And that is, once again, Shalmaneser III. Now, on here, again, it mentions Ben-Hadad and it mentions Hazael. And we've already had him mention Jehu and we've had him mention Omri. But now on the back of this one, it mentions Ahab. And so you go through your Old Testament and how many times it talks about Ahab. Over the Assyrians, they knew about him, and they wrote about him as historically accurate. And Ahab is mentioned 94 times in the Bible. All right, so then we're still... We've gone through two rooms. Actually, we've gone through a room and a half of the British Museum. There's just tons of stuff. So then right behind, right next to that, is this particular wall decoration. And what you're looking at is a predecessor to Shalmaneser. Tiglath-Pileser II is right here. And so then you see that there's a stronghold over here and some people over here. So we're going to talk about them and them here in a second. So let's start with him. That picture is of Tiglath-Pileser III in 2 Kings chapter 15 and verse 19. We have this man mentioned. He's sometimes referred to as Pul, but it says, "Pul, king of Assyria, came against the land, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver so that his hand might be with him to strengthen the kingdom under his rule." So he comes against the northern kingdom, and he kind of conquers them. They start paying him money, right? That's him. That's Tiglath-Pileser. And the inscription tells us those are Israelites. So what did it just say in our Bible? It just said that Tiglath-Pileser came in, he conquered them, and they had to pay. And then we have a wall in Assyria that shows Tiglath-Pileser, and it says the Israelites were bringing tribute to him. And so, by the way, that's what a depiction of an Israelite looked like to them in that time. Okay. I just cannot tell you what these doors, how big they are. These doors that you're looking at here are huge. These are Assyrian doors. They are a replica because the wood obviously would not have lasted. We're talking about a really long time. But just a little bit over to the side, it has these things, these metal things that come across. If I remember correctly, they're bronze. They have those. And so they're able to calculate how big the doors were. These would go into the palace. These would guard the palace in Nineveh. Huge, huge. So it's hard to get the real size because you see this woman here, but she's standing away from it. So if she got there, I mean, she goes up to there. Look at how, that's a massive door. It's just way up there. And if you get to look at all these little crossbars, they all have depictions on them. So I just have one depiction. So you can see that this is kind of a warrior type. And you have dead guys down here getting trampled. And you have a throne over here. I did not get the bottom one, which I understand now is the most gruesome. And I'm sorry you didn't get the most gruesome one to see. I know that's disappointing. So the kings of Assyria boasted about their violence. The door that goes into their palace boasts about their violence. Here's what one of the kings of Assyria said. I built a pillar over against the city gate, and I flayed all the chief men who had revolted, and I covered the pillar with their skins. Some I walled up within the pillar on stakes, and others I bound around the pillar, and I cut off limbs of the officers who had rebelled. From some I cut off their hands, and from others I cut off their noses, their ears, and their fingers. Of many I put out the eyes. Their young men and maidens I burned in the fire. The rest of them I consumed with thirst in the desert of the Euphrates. And so he's just telling everybody, they had a rebellion and this is what I did to them. And then his son will brag about how he's really violent this way. And the kings were known for being very cruel. That was the reputation they had. And then this door, if you go in the palace, the door tells you about all of that. And then Jonah gets this message, arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. You ever wonder why he didn't want to go? The doors told you why he didn't want to go. The doors are massive and huge, and they're telling you, we destroy anybody who speaks against this place, and what's he come to do? And yet 30 days, you will all be destroyed. I can understand why he thought, I'm getting in a boat and going that way first. Okay, so now we're into another room, and these are from Assyria again, and all of these are just decorations that would be on the walls, and they have various depictions on them. In this particular case, it's of the royal hunt. And so the Assyrians wanted to talk about how powerful they were, and so they would gather up all these animals, and then they would go have these massive hunts. We're going to look at this wall right here in particular here. And so on this wall, what you have is the guys getting ready, they're getting their horse together, they've got their weapons, they're getting ready for the hunt, and in this case what we're going to hunt is lions. And so you have this tiny little guy up here who's got this handle, and so he pulls up the handle and off goes the roaring lion, and then the hunt is on, and all of these lions are going. And so this wall just depicts them going off in chariots, and they're taking out the lions all over the place, and the lions are losing. And by the way, that's really detailed. That's an incredible amount of artistry right there. And they're dead. Okay. So this is the last king of Assyria, the last great king, and he wanted to be known for his great lion hunts. Why is this significant? Well, if we turn to the book of Nahum, Nahum is written about the destruction of the Assyrians. That's this time period, this guy. And so starting in chapter 2 and verse 8, and the whole book of Nahum is about the downfall of Assyria, but he says, though Nineveh was like a pool of water throughout her days, now they are fleeing. Stop, stop! But no one turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold, for there is no limit to the treasure. Wealth from every kind of desirable object. She is emptied, yes, she is desolate and waste. Hearts are melting and knees knocking. Also anguish is in the whole body, and all their faces are grown pale. Where is the den of the lions and the feeding place of the young lions? Where the lion, lioness, and lion's cubs prowled with nothing to disturb them? The lion tore enough of his cubs, killed enough for his lionesses, and filled his lairs with prey and his dens with torn flesh. Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts. I will burn up her chariots in smoke. A sword will devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the land, and no longer will the voice of your messengers be heard. And so he describes them. He uses this imagery to describe the Assyrians as lions. Wonder where he got that idea. And so what we see is when the Bible talks about things, we would never have really got that. We wouldn't have really understood that until we get to Assyria. We look at the wall and say, whoa, look what they wanted to be known as. Look what they did. They were collecting all these lions and had these huge lion hunts. And then God says, I'm going to kill the lions. I'm coming after you. You're my hunt. You're my prey. So then we go to Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 20 and verse 1, it says, in the year that the commander came to Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him and he fought against Ashdod and captured it, and on it goes. Just one little phrase in here, and for a long time, people have always looked in the Bible and said, see, here's the evidence that the Bible isn't true. And for a while, we were ridiculed because the Bible mentioned this guy named Sargon. And they hadn't found any name or anything like that in Assyria. And you're mentioning Sargon. Only place in the world. It was the only place in the world that Sargon was mentioned a little while ago. Isaiah 20 and verse 1. Well, in the British Museum, this is believed to be Sennacherib, who's one of the famous kings of Assyria, right? This is his dad, Sargon the Second. Nobody would ever use that name. He's the second guy named Sargon. And they found this, and now all of a sudden, Sargon's not just a guy, he's a huge guy. The Bible was ridiculed for not being accurate because of Sargon. And then all of a sudden we find out Sargon was one of these huge, massive, incredibly powerful kings of Assyria. In fact, so we find this, that's Sargon. And then Sargon starts telling us about the things he did. And Sargon becomes and to rule right when the northern kingdom is destroyed. Right there. He comes into rule right at this crossover. In fact, he takes credit for it in his own writings. He writes, though, that in the first year of his reign, he conquered Samaria, that's the northern kingdom, and replaced the inhabitants with peoples from other nations. Well, if you look at 2 Kings 17, verse 24, when it talks about the downfall of the northern kingdom, it says, the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Cutha and from Ava and from Hamath and from Sepharvaim and settled them in the cities of Samaria in place of the sons of Israel, so they possessed Samaria and lived in its cities, and we know those now as Samaritans. Those are the Samaritans, the good Samaritan in the New Testament. That's the guys that are brought into the northern kingdom and pretend to be Israelites. Sargon says, I did that. The Bible says he did that. Which one do you believe? Well, yes, I believe them both. The evidence collaborates. It works together. Okay. So Sargon has this great big palace, and he has these guys that would guard his palace, and so they're called very creatively human-headed winged bulls. Very creative, right? So you have human head, bull, wings. By the way, this is guarding the palace. Sometime go back and read Ezekiel and Revelation again. Imagery that's just bonkers to us, bizarre, right? We really struggle. If you walked by one of those things every time you went to see the throne, would it change the way you read the book of Revelation? It wasn't as bizarre to them when it talks about these creatures that have all these various things, including a human head. That wasn't weird to them. They were used to that being a sign of power. And the only difference is gods are not stone. His are living and powerful. So there's another one of these in the museum. This is actually two. There's a pair here again. And this one is not a human-headed bull winged because he has claws, and so most likely that's a lion. But you see, you mix different animals together. Okay. Here's another one. This is just the head that they found from the palace of Esarhaddon. I know I butchered that name. But guess what? He's mentioned in the Bible. So Sennacherib, in 2 Kings 19, 36 through 37, so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. It came about as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer killed him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon, his son, became king in his place. Now that's not Esarhaddon, but that is from his palace. They found this, they found him, and we find him. We already knew he existed. He's in the Bible. The Bible tells us about him. Okay. Notice what it tells us about him, though. He becomes king when Sennacherib comes back and he is worshiping in the temple and he is assassinated. Sennacherib's son, Esarhaddon, becomes king. His son then records something in history in Assyria that says his grandfather, Sennacherib, was killed, assassinated, when he was standing between two colossi. So we have that he was assassinated while worshiping. Most likely, he's talking about not necessarily these two particular ones, but he was between two guys like this and he was killed. And it fits very simply, very similar what you see in history and what you see in the Bible. They just fit together so well. But that's not actually why I'm bringing this up. And if you're wondering, I've said, okay, Jared, part one, you don't want to overwhelm them. I feel like I might have already. I'm sorry. We're almost there. Okay, so we've got these two guys here. The real reason why I wanted to bring them up is because under one like that, I don't think it was one of these guys particularly, but under one like that, under one of these statues, they found this rock over here, this inscription. And so I'll pull over and look at that inscription. So you saw from the previous picture, you know, it's about the size of a person, okay? And it's falling apart, and so it's not in very good repair. But here's what it tells us, and this is pretty important. We get another biblical name. This time the name is Hezekiah. And so this inscription that says that Hezekiah paid 800 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And guess what we find in the Bible Hezekiah doing for the Assyrians? In 2 Kings 18, verses 13 through 16, he says, "Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, 'I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear.' So the king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Hezekiah gave him all the silver which was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. At that time, Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the doorposts which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria." Awful thing he does. He takes it from the temple to pay the Assyrians. You'll notice, I'll just give you a little heads up on next month where this is all happening at. Sennacherib is at Lachish.